Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Happy weekend. Welcome to the podcast. You're welcome wherever you are. We have a selection of the best conversations of the week from the show as a warm ear hug for you as you enjoy what we hope is a lovely weekend, although it's not looking great from the vantage point of Friday, but it's looking bright from the prospects of Springsteen, some GAA events and the Premier League coming to a close on Sunday. So I hope you're enjoying that all within the weekend. On this week's episodes, we're going to have chats with Kelly Harrington, Paul Howard and PJ Gallagher in this podcast. And we begin with the boxing legend that is Kelly Harrington. She was in great form when she came into us, talking about her hopes to become the first Irish fighter to successfully defend an Olympic crown in Paris this July and August. Finals of the boxing will be held in August, of course. Now, we had a lovely chat about her preparations for what would be her last Olympics. We talked about losing her first fight in 3 years recently, which was quite a blow from the outside, but inside she said, if you don't learn from losing, only then is it a loss. She talked about how she's looking forward to a normal life with her wife Mandy after Paris, and she got very emotional talking about the death of her beloved dog Macy, who died in January. Paul Howard then is our chat after Kelly. He's also recently lost a pet, Humphrey, his basset hound that was around for 13 years and has left a huge gap in his life. So it was just one of those weeks. But he was our visiting critic, and for the fun, we sent him out of his comfort zone to a dance show at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin. And in fact, his description is so detailed and he's so spirited about it that he'd make you want to go to see a dancing show after his wonderful descriptions. And finally, the third and last thing in the podcast is a conversation with PJ Gallagher, and it's about his new documentary Changing My Mind, which is going on RTE One television on Monday the 20th of May. You know PJ, of course, from being funny on television and elsewhere for the last 20 years or more, but he's also a very vocal mental health warrior. And that's what the documentary is about. There are gorgeous moments in it with men's groups and PJ's story as well. And we discover the many setbacks that he had. But mostly we find out that PJ is doing and feeling really, really well. He's still into his motorbiking. He's become a dad in his late 40s. And he's back with a new season of The Young Offenders. So enjoy that talk with him. Thanks a million for listening. Subscribe to the show on your app. Thanks for all the support, the texts and the messages that we get on the wireless too. That's on RT Radio 1 after 9 a.m. until 10 every Monday to Friday. So enjoy the podcast. Cue the tune and in we go. Boxing legend Kelly Harrington is hoping to become the first Irish fighter to successfully defend an Olympic crown in Paris this July and August. No Irish athlete, this is how significant this is, no Irish athlete has managed to defend an Olympic gold medal in any sport since 1932, I think it was a hammer throw, something like that, Dr. Pat O'Callaghan, which kind of highlights the near impossibility of the task, or is it? She is our guest this morning, Kelly Harrington, welcome.
Thank you very much, thanks for having me.
I hope I didn't intimidate you with that sort of introduction of
I'm sweating. I am here.
Oh yeah, yeah, she's intimidated as ever.
I'm like, oh Jesus Christ, there's a lot to live up to here.
do you don't like that pressure though? There's a bit of pressure being, oh, it's just Kelly, that's another medal in the bag for us.
Well,
not a fan of that.
That's like, that's the way people look. They're like, oh, you're going to get the gold. And I'm like, no, it's not that easy. Like, you know, there's like loads of other girls out there who want the gold.
World.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In the world, yeah. Like, it's not easy. But look, we'll go out swinging and give it a bash and see what happens.
We won so much, you see, we just expect it to happen now.
That's it. Effort. Like, you know, whereas I just expect a performance. That's all. I don't like, I'm not looking for, not that I'm not looking for a medal, Jesus, it'd be great to get a medal, do you know, like, but yeah. I'm going out there to perform and just to feel good, and because I haven't really felt good with boxing in a while, like, in myself, like, you know, like, I'm feeling a little bit slow and so on, so on. Mm. I'm starting to feel a bit better now, so I'm feeling good again. So slowly but surely, I'm getting back to that feeling, because it's a weird feeling, like it's embracing the unknown, you know, like when you're stepping in there, and I'm starting to really want that again. Like there's an element of fear that keeps you alive and keeps you on your toes, and I haven't really had that in a while. I suppose I qualified for the Olympics last year, so it's a long time since I've qualified, you know.
Yeah.
And you're kind of, you're more or less sitting idle then, you're training away, but you're not
in your head for a long time.
Yeah, you know. So now that it's finally here in 11 weeks, I'm starting to zone in now. The tunnel is getting narrower by the day and vision is starting to get more clearer.
Is the fear a fear of getting hurt or a fear of losing?
So sometimes the fear of losing becomes greater than the joy of winning for some people, you know. And
yeah.
It's not that it's greater than the joy of winning or anything for me at the moment, because I'm not afraid to lose, but fear for me lets me know I'm alive. It gives me adrenaline and I kind of feel like I'm able to get on my feet a little bit more. I'm able to move more freely because, like, I actually dodge punches quicker. Whereas if you're not afraid to get a punch, you're going to take the punch. Do you know, like?
Yeah.
I know that sounds really weird. Like, and then I'm like, have you ever been punched in the face before?
Unfortunately, yeah. But not competitively. And I still lost anyway. Not recently either.
I'm gonna leave it at that.
Just leave it there. Come here, because is the pressure eased a little bit now? Because, sorry to bring it up, but you lost the first fight in 3 years, I think it was, wasn't it, only recently?
Yeah.
Pretty big one.
So it's not that, the questions that people have asked are like, I wonder did she just lose that to try and take the pressure off? No one goes out to just lose, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's like, I'm not afraid of losing. Like, I'm not afraid of losing. I've lost more fights than I've had hot dinners nearly, do you know?
Mm.
It's just since I'm in the public eye, I haven't lost a fight, you know?
Well, we were kind of shocked.
Yeah, that's it. It's like, I'm shocked that people are shocked. I'm like, this is sport, you know, this is life. And it's a part of what I do. It's a part of my journey, you know? And for a little girls and boys and men and women to be able to see that now, that, you know, like, you can reach the top of your sporting career and you can lose, but you can get back up and you can go again. You know, you don't have to stay down. It's about getting back up and going again. And look, who knows what's going to happen in the future, whether I'm going to win, lose, whatever, like, you know, but it's about getting back up and having the hunger and desire to get back up. I also do think it did put a little bit of a spark under my ass, you know,
right?
to get me going again, you know, and that's probably where I'm getting the feeling back again, you know.
Because you were saying you weren't happy in your boxing. Naturally, you were going to lose then.
Yeah.
So that was a semi-final of the European Elite Championships. It was only about 3 or 4 weeks ago, wasn't it?
It was only about 3 weeks ago.
But you still came home with a medal.
I still came home with a medal, a bronze medal. We got a couple of bronze and we got two golds out there. So the team is absolutely flying. Like, the Irish boxing team is flying at the moment. We've 6 qualified for the Olympics as it stands.
Yeah.
And there's a qualifiers now. The last Olympic qualifier is out in Bangkok later on this month.
Really?
So we have a team of 7 out there at the moment and hoping that we can get a few more across the line so they can be on the plane with us over to Paris.
And you're a huge supporter of your fellow boxers, aren't you? You're also going around the place, boxing clubs around the country.
Yeah.
How do you have the time?
I suppose, like, I always fit my own training and sparring into it if I'm going anywhere, do you know? So you're kind of killing the one board, what's that saying? Killing the board with...
Punching a bird with...
With two stones or... Oh, I can't remember. Here, look, I'm taking too many punches, obviously.
But it's good to see that you're unfazed by that. And it was in Serbia, wasn't it? It was in Belgrade. You lost to the Serb in our home place, which she obviously had that advantage as well.
So no, and that's the thing. So I see the way, like, she had that advantage. Like, look, listen, I lost, I lost fair and square. You know, people were saying, oh, I thought you got it. I'm like, no, I lost the fight and that's it. You know, I lost it. We get back up.
Matter
we go again. Do you know what I mean? There's nothing wrong with losing. You know, it's only a loss if you don't learn from it. And I'm learning. You know, sometimes we win and you don't really learn anything from it. And I'd love now people to understand that we're all only human and you get back up and you go again. You know, it's a part of life. Loss is a part of life, whether that be in sport or in your personal life.
No matter what we're doing.
Exactly.
You just have to keep going. They're texting in already. 51551 on the text. Could you ask Kelly, does it help to ease the pressure knowing that there seems to be a lot of genuine medal chances with Ireland this Olympics? Now, this is our fault in the media, isn't it? Kind of going, look at all these medals we're going to win.
Yeah. The honest answer to that is yes, it does actually help. So I don't feel like the weight of the world is on my shoulders,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And I do think that we have a lot of medal potential across Irish sports, you know, and like we're thriving as a country in sport, yeah, you know, and it's a credit to Sport Ireland and to yeah, all of
and also
the
work
the
that you did before, because you know, bringing home medals encourages someone else, the next generation, they want to go. We should mention Paula Donovan as well. Of course, he's a rower who would be defending his gold Olympic gold medal. So it's not just on you to be the first since
yeah,
Patrick
exactly.
Allen
himself
in
and Vinton will be out there, and they'll be trying to come back with
to defend it.
Yeah.
How are you today? Were you interrupting a regime of yours now at this stage, 9:15?
I was up this morning, had a sauna, had a cold shower, doing a bit of media this morning, and then I am off later on to join the boxing team. They're out in Assisi in Italy at a training camp out there. So
really?
It's a multinations training camp, and I'm going to head out later on today and get sparring on the way tomorrow. So a couple of test matches out there and then come home. So this is what it's all about now, like going away and testing yourself and seeing where you're at, like, and that's what I want to get out there now and see how I am. There's no pressure, there's no winner and loser, but it's a test match, you know, and you can try and work on things that you've been doing in the gym and stuff like that, and see if it actually works for you out there.
We've come a long, long way, haven't we? I know, because the stories you tell in your book with Roddy Doyle, I think that was 2 years ago, that book you did? It was a huge book anyway. Everyone kind of read it. But it was interesting to see that you couldn't even get into boxing clubs when you were a teenager, weren't you? Or even later into your 20s.
And now boxing clubs are trying to get women in, like, you know, like, I don't know.
Hardly room.
That's it, like, you know, like, times have changed, obviously, for the better. And it's incredible. It really is. Like, we've so many fantastic athletes, male and female. But I'm going to give a shout out to the females. And just, they're so good. Like, we have young Ava Henry. She's one that, like, I'm telling you, you're hearing it here now. Ava Henry, top class. She's going to be in the next Olympics or the one after it. Like, she is unbelievable.
Really?
And there's plenty more girls as well coming through, yeah, you know, plenty more. It's well, just brilliant.
We've got medals in the last month and there's more coming.
Yeah.
So you're confident for the team, isn't that the fairest way?
I'm confident for Team Ireland, boxing and all other sports. I'm very confident for them, you know, because training is a different level nowadays, like with all the like physiologists and psychologists, and that's it. Like, you know, there's so much more now to training than just training. So I am quite confident in the team across the board, like Team Ireland.
And we have to be world class, because that's the thing you forget when we start winning medals in the Olympics, that this is the best of the whole planet.
But the thing about it is, like, if you're getting to the Olympic Games, you are world class. You know, you are like a very, very small percentage in that world of actually getting there. There's so many athletes in the world and only a small percentage get to the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
So to even get there is phenomenal in itself, you know.
It's going to be different this time, isn't it? Because last time it was the middle of lockdown. It was a bit of a lonely time, really, wasn't it? It was only athletes cheering athletes on, no family. Very few people could go, wasn't it, in Tokyo?
Yeah, so like that suited me down to a T.
Did it?
If I could go into a room and fight and then and it be over, like, then I would enjoy that, like, you know. It would be very, very different. So it's all about now how the athletes control what they can control, you know, like, and then the stuff that they can't control, they just got to push that aside and just focus on what they're out there to do, because there's going to be a lot of outside noise when we're over there.
Well, because nearby, you know,
it's in
Paris, there's going to be a lot of Irish people.
Oh, people
there
are talking about driving over in busloads and everything. It's like the Irish are great, they really
camper
are.
Camper vans,
like,
will be out again.
And to be honest, I don't even know if like Mandy is going over, but I don't know, like, her and my brother and his partner, I don't know anything about where they're staying. I don't know if they're coming to watch me fight. That's all I know, like, because I'm like, don't tell me anything. But what I do know is, and I always know this, no matter where you're boxing, there's always Irish people there to cheer for you. So I never rely on my family because I get so panicky, you know, like.
Do you?
So
because Mandy's been by your side, like.
She has, yes. Oh, she's been like 15 years, you know, so.
Is that right?
It's mad. But I always know whatever stadium you're in, you're always going to hear Irish people. It's just crazy. Like, they come from everywhere.
And they know who you are as well.
And even if they don't, they just get behind their own.
Yeah. Sorry. So will that feel like a bit of pressure? Or do you think in your head, are you already there, Paris Olympics, because they're going to do the opening ceremony on the River Seine, and that's where the athletes are going to be in these. We were talking to Laura Weber. We got all excited because she's the designer of the Irish Olympics uniform, and she's designed it because the potential for heatwave is massive in July, August. Like, do you allow yourself to go, right, I'm going to enjoy this, because you've already said this is going to be your last Olympics?
Yeah. I don't, that's being honest, I don't even know when the boxing starts. That's how much I kind of like disassociate with the actual Olympics. I know I'm training for a big, big tournament, you know. And I suppose it's kind of when we get there, we see how far out from the competition is to the actual opening ceremony, if we can actually go on the opening ceremony, you know. If we're close to starting competition,
we won't
be there, you know. And that would be a spectacular event to go to, wouldn't it, really?
Oh, like, I believe, you know, I'd say everyone in the world wants to be there and, like, to be in your position, yeah, with the you view know? You're going to get.
And everybody keeps saying, enjoy it, like, you know. And, like, I've been talking to Sonia O'Sullivan, and she's been saying, you know, like, things that she would regret would be not enjoying the second time round and stuff.
Right.
So people are telling me, enjoy it. Like, don't let it pass you by, you know, especially that it's going to be my last one, you know. So,
yeah.
So I'll try to enjoy it. But
yeah,
I mean,
it's not in your plan exactly.
Yeah,
it might just happen on the day sort of thing.
Yeah.
Have you seen the uniform, by the way? Have they been sent to you? Do you get
we
to
haven't,
try it on?
We haven't tried them on yet, but I have seen it, and it's nice. Yeah.
It's really cool. You got there's a county thing and everything, I think, on the shoulder. You'll see it when you see it.
Yeah, I'll see it when I see it.
Your head is in other places, naturally enough. Here I am, just trying to train to win an Olympic, retain an Olympic medal.
We'll have to see, can we get you one?
I'd love to see one. There might be small bit of controversy. Swanning around. Olympic medal. They probably don't make it of my size.
Ah, stop it, will you?
Come here to me. How are things at home, Mandy, obviously? What's it like for Mandy living with a person preparing for the Olympics? Because I think you were doing up a house and everything last year, so you're doing all the hardest things all at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, we don't do things in half, me and Mandy. Like, we literally, it's all or nothing with us. But she's fine. She's doing okay. She's my rock, basically. Do you know? She's the one who, there's days when you feel like you don't want to get out of bed and stuff like that, you know, like, because everybody has them days. We're human and, you know, emotions and stuff like that. She'll make sure I'm up, and she'll remind me of why I'm doing it. And she also reminds me, it's only 11 weeks away. Do you know what I mean?
She's just the one who has
pushing.
The date.
Do you know what I mean? Just keep pushing. You're nearly there.
So important to have someone like that,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. No, it definitely is. Like, it's, and I probably don't give her half the credit that she deserves, to be honest with you. But I promise, when the Olympics is over, we will get to live somewhat of a normal life, because we are both craving that normality, you know,
because
we haven't really had normal in our life, you know. So we're both craving it at this stage.
And that's just being busy, isn't it?
That's just busy, yeah.
Training, going around to the boxing clubs because you're a mentor. You have the Kelly Harrington Fun Day, which I presume won't happen this year because you'll be busy.
Oh, no, it'll be happening after the Olympics. I'm hoping to have
the Northeast inner city, yeah.
That's it, yeah.
You're a spa ambassador, which you're here today. We'll talk about that in a minute. I mean, it's busy, busy, busy.
Busy, busy, busy. I love my community. So that's why, like, when I came back from the Olympics the last time, I had the Kelly Harrington Fun Day. That's every year.
Yeah.
I have a Christmas show now as well. I've had it for the last 2 years. I just love the community. I love
Kelly Harrington Panto.
No, but I love it, you know, and Mandy's loving it now as well, like, you know. So we're not actually in fully into town yet.
Oh, you're
but
not
we
okay.
will be after the Olympics, and Mandy is starting to really like being a townie.
In the middle of still you're renovating a house.
Well, it's done. We're just waiting till after the Olympics.
Very good.
you know.
We're following that. You mentioned you're a very proud of your community because you never fail to mention Portland Row, inner city. I think in every interview I've ever seen you do. It has such an important role. I know you say there's a bit of pressure when you have Irish people all around you and they kind of assume you're going to win. But specifically, what does your community do for you?
They lift you when you're down, and they keep pushing you up when you're up. You know, it's just walking out. Like I walked Mandy. She was going to the cinema last week in Smithfield. So I was like, I'm going to walk you up because I didn't want to go. And she was meeting a group of friends, and so I walked her up. At like 4:45, I didn't get home till 7:45 that night. Now, bear in mind, I didn't go anywhere. I just walked up.
You were just walking,
and just stopping and talking to people that you know from around. It's just great, you know. And there's no boxing talk. It's just talk in general, with people that are from around, and everyone just wants you to do good, and you want them to do good, and it's just I just love being in town. I just love it.
And growing up there, you just know so many people all around you.
I know so many people around me. Even the people that you don't know, you say hello to. It's, you know everything about the city. You know what it's like. You know what they're like. And, you know, it's just a part of who I am. And I love it. I don't know. I think most people who do well from the inner city like to talk about the inner city.
They do. No, it's true, because we've had them here. We had the talking bee, Ollocks guys, if you could say that.
Yeah.
And with Peter Sheridan as well and Ellie Conroy talking about the play they were doing. It's unbelievable. And Arkin's Dance Academy, which you're going off to represent Ireland in the World Cup in Prague.
Yeah.
And the listeners here raise money for them. I mean, they give everyone a lift across the country, of course. It's not just inside the place. What was the name of the film you didn't go to see with Mandy?
God, I couldn't tell you. That's being honest with you. Bear in mind, it was roasting out that day. I was like, there's no way can I sit in there on a lovely day like this. I'll fall asleep 10 minutes in.
You spend longer chatting to people anyway.
Do you know, but she said it was great. So I'll take her word for it.
I was sorry to read that you lost one of your dogs, yourself and Mandy, and a few months ago.
Yeah, we lost Macy. She would have been 15 in May this year.
All right. That's a long innings for a dog, I'd imagine, anyway, is it?
Yeah, it is. Like, she was getting old, and she just loved to love. Like, that's it. I can feel the lump coming in my throat.
It really affected you, didn't it?
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. And what sort of...
sorry.
No, it's okay. No, take your time. What kind of dog?
She's a Staffordshire Bull Terrier, she was.
Oh, wow.
And we were away when it happened, so it was just... Yeah, it wasn't nice. Anybody who has a dog. Do you have a dog?
We do. Well, I grew up with dogs. We don't have one ourselves. The husband, Mr. Lennon, is mad for a dog.
But anyone who has a dog will know what it's like to lose a dog. You come into the house and they're jumping up on you. They're so happy to see you. They're the most loyalist thing. A dog is probably the only animal or the only thing in the world that will love you more than they actually love itself, you know. And it's just, that's what we got. She was nearly like a human, you know.
Yeah, that's what she meant to you.
Yeah.
There are other dogs now in the house as well. Do you have two or three?
We had three. We have two now. We still have Nidge and Gus.
Well, Nidge is still going.
He's Nidge. And when he does something bold, he's Nigel. Nigel! And Gus, they're two characters. But they keep us going. And, you know, a loss is never easy with an animal, but you have to keep going for the other two dogs, you know. And and they missed her as well at the start. They were kind of pining for her for a few weeks, really.
Well, they were looking at you.
Yeah, it's mad.
Pining
for
Macy.
Still, we have our ashes and stuff, and I still say good morning and good night to her every time I'm home. Yeah. And some people might think that's weird, but it's comforting for me.
Something nice like that shouldn't be weird.
Yeah.
Anything Kelly Harrington does is absolutely fine by us. speaking of the inner city, one of my favourite stories in the book that you told was you used to do sponsored walks, in inverted commas, collecting money for sponsored walks. And maybe the walk didn't happen. But somebody who gave you money for this sponsored walk, tell a story, because were you coming home from Tokyo when this person, years later?
Years later, yeah, Carmel and And God rest her soul now, Carmel has since passed. Yeah. But years later, she said it. She was like, remember you used to knock with your sponsor cards? Because we'd only write them up, you know, like, and she'd sponsor you every time. And she always knew there was no walk or there was no skip-a-ton, do you know? I actually haven't seen kids going around with them around the door.
Well, after this morning.
But that's the things you do when you're a kid. It's just amazing. And the innocence of it all, you know.
Yeah.
For what? Like for a couple of chomps and the rest in jellies.
Packet
meanies a chomp and can I get the rest in jellies, please, mister?
I just love that Carmel. I think you're on an open top bus, aren't you, with the medal?
Yeah.
Carmel just shouts up.
Oh, I tell you.
You owe me €2.
Oh, like absolutely. Oh, I tell you now, like that, and that's what it's, you know, like memories like that you'll have for a lifetime, you know.
That's the spirit of the place is what you're talking about,
that's
isn't
it?
Your resilience of getting up from the knock and from losing a fight, does some of that discipline come from the army, your time in the army?
I'd like to say yes, but probably not. I wasn't in it long enough.
Yeah.
I was only there for 4 months, like, you know. But I just think the resilience that I have comes from growing up where I grew up, you know. Yeah. I think people from the inner city are very resilient people. You know, we've had enough knocks and throughout our life, you know, and you learn to bounce back and basically not give a you know what about what anybody thinks, just to get up and keep going. Because if you were to worry about what people think, then you'd get nowhere, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I think that's where the resilience come from.
When you look at your story in the army, it's kind of a bit of a knock as well, wasn't it? Because you were one of the few women involved. I think they were separating them too, wasn't it? You've just, as a chatter, you didn't like being on your own,
you know. So I would have been downstairs and the lads would have all been upstairs, and it just was very lonely. Now here, like, I mean, it's only 4 months, like.
Yeah.
Still,
when you're that young,
it's very hard.
Long.
Do you know what I mean?
Time.
That's the thing. When you're that young, 4 months is very hard. Now, I think it has all changed since in the army.
Yeah.
And there is a lot more women now, like, enlisting in the army. But I think it has changed a bit. Like, the training has changed a bit. I think it's not as hard or anything now as it used to be. But yeah, I think the training has changed.
But the thing was, you were separated because there were so few women. All the crack was upstairs.
And
that's where you wanted to be, obviously.
I was downstairs listening to Westlife, you know, crying and saying, I want to go home. I don't want to do this anymore. And every time I'd go home, I'd say to me, Matt and that, you know, like, and they'd be like, well, just leave. You know, if you don't want to do it, just leave, like, you know.
That's what you did.
And no, I didn't until like 4 months later. But this was like every weekend.
Was
I was like,
right?
I'm going, you know, like. But I still ended up going back. And to be honest with you, I think leaving was probably the best thing for me to do at the time, because I probably wouldn't be where I am in my sporting career if I didn't leave. But I did try to get back in afterwards. Oh, Jesus, I must have been nearly 30 when I tried to get back in. But they had that, like, the aptitude test. Is that, like,
put you right off.
I may as well be talking to a wall doing a test, like, you know. But it's safe to say I didn't pass it. But I would have just liked to get back in to do the training.
Incredible. So you did take the test, but they weren't letting you back in.
I'd say the score, I'd say I didn't get one answer right or anything, you know.
You were testing the wrong part.
I tell you, that's it, you know. But I mean, when you think about it, would you really want me defending your country, like, if I can't get, like,
you do defend
one
the country
one right?
Literally what you're doing, what you're going to do in Paris.
Yeah, so I just wanted to go back to prove I'm going to do this training, like. And I probably also wanted to, like, if someone said something to me, to stand up for myself, you know, like. But so that's not what the army is about, you know. You got to take orders and that, like. But a part of me wanted to be like, well, I'm not gonna, you know, like. So,
but it's
probably just as well I didn't get back.
Better for women now. So you changed the defence forces and you changed boxing for women as well. We'll credit you. No need to comment, Kelly. Loads of love on the message for you, but we better mention the Spar Community Fund, which is what you're here to talk about, and that's what your business is at the moment. What is the Spar Community Fund?
So the Spar Community Fund, it started in 2021, but this year in 2024, Spar is we're doing a Stay in the Game campaign. So it's basically Stay in the Game. It's aimed at young girls to try and get them to stay in sport. Because like one in five teenagers finish sport post-primary school. So like we're trying to, I'm not saying that like we're going to get everybody to stay in sport, but it would be great if we could get a couple. So we're trying to get them to stay involved in sport. And there's a campaign coming up now, and it'll go live actually today for anyone to nominate their local school or club that are pushing for women, you know. And there's €2,000 to be won. So you got to nominate.
Yeah, so a member of the public can nominate the secondary school
or a club.
Or the club, great.
At spur.ie/community fund. It will be open later on. The link will be up later on.
It's 10 but, grand, yeah. So 5 grand. By 2. So, okay,
yeah.
So
you know, which goes an awful long way, you know.
Yeah. Well, actually, not so long ago, someone was in touch with us looking for money in a boxing club that they were struggling in. They said it was somewhere in the inner city. I can't remember.
There you
exactly
go.
Where.
You know, like, get in and send in your nomination, you know. I'm not saying every boxing club is going to get it, like, but, you know, if you're not in, you can't win.
Yeah, exactly. If you're not nominated, it's not going to happen. That's to, it's a continued participation of teenage girls in sport. Again, that's improving a lot as well, isn't it? The girls in green in football
brilliant.
Are unbelievable.
Absolutely.
They're in the Euro qualifiers at the moment. And actually, there's a story today about Parky Keeve maybe hosting them for the last qualifier, such as the numbers that are now going to the matches. There's loads of love on the text for you, Kelly, and particularly people are very touched about losing Macy. Losing a dog is like losing a family member. It's heartbreaking, says this message here. I lost my dog, Bruno, so know what it's like for Kelly. Enjoy the Paris and enjoy the Olympics, Kelly, says Helen in County Meath. Kelly, such a lovely down-to-earth girl.
Thanks very much. And you know what? Like, you can talk all day, right, about anything, but as soon as you talk about a dog, dog people get it. Dog people know dog people, you know, and it's everybody, like, it's hard. Like, it is hard. Like, the love for an animal, like, you are all they have, you know, you are literally all they have.
I think
so
people
thanks very much for sending your messages in. Really appreciate
for
it.
For sure, there's more of them. We won't have time to come to all of them, but it's also...
I just want to give a shout out, actually, because my dad came into the house this morning to let me know he'd be listening. So, how are you, dad? And to anybody else who is listening in.
I didn't even get a chance to ask, but you're still working away, are you, in St. Vincent's?
I am. Well, I'm still employed, but I haven't been there now in... Since January, I'd say I stopped. Yeah. I stopped at the end of January, just so I could focus
for
on training.
Reasons, yeah,
but
they're very good. Yeah.
As soon as I'm out of the Olympics, like, I'm going straight back to work. That's what I want to do.
That's what you vowed the last time, and you did it.
And I did it.
You're going to do it again. And that's part of the normal life that you want to have.
I just crave normality. I'm not flashy. I just want the simple little things in life, and I want to be able to look after me family and my extended family and. Just to do little things in my community for people who need it, you know. That's all I want. Like, I don't, like, I'm not asking for much.
Look, they love you here on the text. We love you. Your hero status is already done. I know you don't care about a lot of that stuff, but it's worth saying you won an Olympic gold medal for Ireland in Tokyo that time. I think you might have said you won it for your country that stage, and maybe the next time you'll think about doing it just for you and Mandy.
Yeah.
That's where your head is for
that's
Paris.
That's it. This time I'm just gonna do it for myself. Like, try and just perform and try to do it for myself. And I'm gonna try and enjoy it. Like, I know it's very hard to enjoy it when you're that competitive, and you know, and you've given it everything and you train every day. You know, it is hard to enjoy it. And when I say it's hard to enjoy it, I mean, like, enjoy it means like walking around and swapping your badges, because you get these little pins and. Like, people swap them, so you might give an Irish pin for a Puerto Rican pin or a Japanese pin, you know,
oh,
and
right,
people go around
yeah.
putting them on their, you have this little lanyard thing, you know, like it goes around your neck and what have you. But I didn't get to do any of that the last time, and you go to watch other sporting events and stuff. All I really done was from the accommodation to the food hall to the training venue. And if it wasn't that, then I'd be fighting, you know, and that was it. Like, and I used to love though sitting in the food hall, looking at people coming in all different shapes and sizes and nationalities, and wondering what sport it was that they actually played. You know, like it was great. Like, and you could sit there and you'd guess with your teammates, and then you'd have to get up and ask, "Sorry, what sport do you play?" And then you'd be like, "Yes, that's one to me." You know, like, so
yeah
that's about the height they got when we were in Tokyo. So Paris will be a whole different
Very
level.
Different.
So yeah, we'll see.
I hope you get to see the opening ceremony and the closing ceremony. You missed that as well the last time, the closing ceremony in Tokyo. But look, mostly we hope that your Olympics is everything that you want it to be. You'll still be Kelly at the end of it.
Exactly.
And that's a win alone. Now, you're going to choose our song for us, aren't you?
I am.
Because you're big into your music and your singing.
So this was the last song that I actually uploaded onto my Spotify. So I hope you like it.
So did you
train
to this?
It's a bit of an upbeat song. It's Natasha Benningfield and Badger. I actually only... seen who it was because I just
Badger has remixed Natasha Benningfield.
He's remixed.
There's
yeah.
no emotional attachment to this song other than that. I just stuck it on my Spotify and I trained to it. 51551. We should train to it as well.
Yeah.
So, thank you much, Kelly Harrington. The best of luck to you.
Thanks very much.
Slán
thanks for having
thanks
me.
So much.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, you are all very welcome back. Best-selling, award-winning author, journalist, playwright, musicals writer.
That's enough.
Screenwriter, that's another one. Comedy writer, performer. Paul Howard is a visiting critic, creator of Ross O'Carroll Kelly.
And now dance, interpretive dance expert.
Yeah,
sorry, right?
I'm not finished. Coppers the musical, writer of Bad Sisters, sports memoirist as well, of course. Incredible tower of work. In fact, you should just stop now. You know?
Please do.
You've not done enough. Paul Howard, very welcome to the studio. Visiting critics, so we get people out of their comfort zone. Did we manage to do it?
Oh, you did. I mean, like, you know, I was the worst person to send this to in a lot of ways, which I'm sure you're delighted about. I remember being in Galway once and I saw a dance group attempt to tell the story of the bank bailout through interpretive dance. So this was a hard sell for me.
With lots of movement where you just expect
lots of sort of bendy bodies and all that kind of thing, you know, towards a ferry, you know, the sort of emigrant
trail.
Sorry,
I'm still thinking of the banking crash dance.
Oh, right.
But this one you went to was specifically 13 Tongues, is that what it's called?
Yeah, I mean, there were bendy bodies in both, I should add. It was called 13 Tongues and it's based on, it's a choreographer from Taiwan called Cheng Sung Lung.
Right.
And it's based on his memories of his neighborhood growing up in Taiwan.
Okay.
So he was born in Taipei City's Bangka district, which I stayed for the talk afterwards. And he said this was a pretty rough neighborhood he lived in. 2 million people resident there.
Wow.
The plan was that the production was supposed to represent the sort of chaotic nature of life in this particular region.
Right. And the set kind of...
In dance,
yeah. Because I'm there thinking, do they have a huge set that kind of shows ramshackle buildings or...
No. I mean, it was very spare. The stage design was very spare. It was sort of black screen at the back.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the costumes were black. It wasn't very, very colourful. And that may well have been the design, you know, the fact that it was kind of sparingly designed. Occasionally a koi, an enormous koi, would come and swim on the black screen at the back.
Oh, right.
And... he was asked afterwards in the talk, what was the significance of the koi? And he said, well, it doesn't really have any significance. I just dreamt about a koi while we were in production.
Yeah.
A giant goldfish, I think.
He said, I dreamt about it.
So he said, I dreamt about this. And I came into work the next day and said, can we put a koi in this? And they said, yes, which kind of sums it up, really. You know, there's a lot of sort of dreamy, esoterical stuff going on.
Everybody was thinking of the metaphor of a fish and going, oh, I wonder this meal for
that's
like
it.
An hour or whatever.
And see, then
he just says, I had a dream, stuck it in.
Everybody's looking for, well, certainly I am looking for the significance of it, right? So I am... Like, I'm that person that Van Morrison hates, for instance, right? Like, Van Morrison hates people who say, what's that song about? Like, I'm the guy who says, but what is Madame George about? I'm always looking for the meaning. And with a show like this, it's not about the meaning. It's about the vibe, you know? And I went in purposefully, blissfully ignorant. I knew nothing about it. I decided I'm not going to read a single thing beforehand.
Good plan.
And I didn't. I don't think I lost anything for not kind of educating myself in advance about what it was about, because what it's about really for me is the movement of the 13 dancers on stage, which is extraordinary.
Is it? Is it actually?
Amazing. I mean, I kept thinking of this is my, you know, this is ignorant dance me talking. Like, I just kept thinking of The Matrix and those sort of people bending backwards
in slow motion to avoid
bullets. Like, that's what it was like. You're talking about dancers with zero body fat, I'm guessing, like an incredible control over their bodies. And there's all this sort of like, you know, these sort of wide legged crouches, and they manage to maintain their balance, and they're sort of arms snaking, and, you know, they become flowers, and then they move in this way. When they move together, the 13 of them, which is like, I think it's called a murmuration of starlings. You know, when you see starlings,
nice image,
when
yep.
they fed and they kind of move in those shapes. That stuff was extraordinary.
And what's the music then?
Well, the music kind of reminded me a bit of jazz, like, you know, it was
really?
Kind of like boom, dunk, dunk. It was kind of industrial music.
Do more of that.
Dunk, 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 dunk. Oh, it was kind of like, you know, jazz played on a glockenspiel or something, like, you know. But it was, there was lots of chanting.
There was
laughter from the dancers as well at what you thought were inappropriate places. So the music always sort of kept you a little bit, you know, off kilter.
Mm. What sort of crowd does a dance festival attract?
That's the thing, right? So it was in the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, and I was thinking, it's a huge theatre. I know I failed to fill it many, many times with my shows.
I didn't mention that in the intro.
And so I was thinking, how are they going to get 2,200 people in? Because it wasn't one performance, you know. The top tier was closed, but the next two tiers down were about three quarters full. So, I mean, there must have been, I'm guessing, 1,500 people there.
Is there an atmosphere at a dance show?
Well, that's the thing. There was an atmosphere of anticipation beforehand.
Yeah.
Once it started, there was silence. And I mean silence to the point where I could hear my pen scratching on my notebook as I wrote down my notes, such as they were. Well, I do too. It makes me nervous because I'm thinking, is everybody enjoying this? Like, you know, but they clearly were, because it got a standing ovation at the end. Mm. But there is that thing of, you're thinking, why aren't they getting a round of applause for that thing I've just seen? Like, there was amazing movements, and, you know, these little sort of vignettes from the choreographer's life, they would interpret them in dance. And I would kind of think at the end, well, that deserves a round of applause. But there seems to be this contract between the audience and the performers that nobody claps until the end. So I'm just sitting there nervous.
How do they learn this?
Is anybody enjoying this?
It must be the odd person who gets up and starts clapping.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to cheer. Like, there was 6 or 7 points where I just wanted to go, yes, well done.
Isn't this why some of us are kind of scared of these high arts spaces? Because you go to classical music or the opera and you feel like, oh, there's been a crescendo sort of happening there. I should have clapped. And you're looking around and no one is. And you just put your hands away.
That's it. And then there's the fear of missing out. Like, you know, you're kind of sitting there thinking, is there something I'm not getting here? Like, you know.
That's right, yeah.
So I was much relieved at the end to find out, somebody said to me afterwards, you know, it is what you want it to be. And I love hearing that at the end of something, you know.
You didn't miss anything.
Feel that. But there was some amazing parts. Like, there was this bit where all the, maybe 12 of the dancers who were all dressed in black, they picked this dancer up from the middle of this little melee. And she's wearing this sort of multicoloured tunic, kind of a coat.
Yeah.
And whatever way the light shines on it, it was spectacular, because it's mostly a sort of monochrome stage. And then there's this coat comes out and you're just mesmerized by the coat. And they're sort of tossing this woman about the place, sort of throwing her from group to group. And then suddenly you realize, oh my God, the coat is empty. So they've lost her somewhere. Right? It was David Blaine stuff. Like, she's gone, like, you know. And I love
that
magicians.
That was a round of applause.
I'm always fooled by magicians. Like, I think, that's amazing. She really has disappeared. But there was no explanation as to what, I would have loved to have known what that particular scene meant in his life. Like, was that something that featured in his life?
But no, the
lesson
stood
was,
up at a date.
She's just gone. Yeah.
She's just gone. Yeah. She never showed up. 13 tongues. How long was it, by the way?
It was an hour and 10 minutes long.
All the way through?
All the way straight through.
Oh, wow.
So it started at 8 and it finished at 9:10. I wasn't bored. I want to say that, like, you know, I'm obviously ignorant when it comes to dance, but I wasn't bored for a second of it. But I wasn't leaving saying that could have been half an hour longer.
But that was just but the right amount.
I thought it was just enough dance.
I was relieved to clap, you know? After.
Yeah, I was. I was like, well, I was relieved that everybody loved it. Like,
10,
you know?
And there was no movement from the crowd.
Nothing at all. I mean, complete and utter silence that you could hear, kind of thing, you know.
Do people get up and go to the bathroom? Now I'm more intrigued about the crowd.
No, not at all. No, everybody is motionless. Like, you know, I've been, like, I'm a big snooker fan. I used to go and see the snooker at the Benson Hedges Irish Masters and Goffs. And that was silence. But occasionally you would hear people shifting in their seats, or that sort of epidemic of coughing when somebody starts. Yeah. Nothing like that. It was pure zen-like quiet and you know, movelessness, if you want to call it that. And they were amazing. I mean, the crowd, I thought, were part of the performance, really, you know. Just how they managed to stay completely silent, I don't know.
I'm thinking about coughing crowds. There was a comedian telling me recently that everybody at an Irish gig, they were doing shows in America, and it was only when they realised, they came home, was like, oh my God, everyone in Ireland is just coughing and hacking the way through every show they do. Yeah. It's like in America, they had no recollection of that level of
illness,
damp lungs, or something.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Like, and once one person does it, it's like they give permission to everybody else in the audience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that
kicks it off.
Oh, it can be desperate sometimes. So that is the Dublin Dance Festival, which runs until the 25th of May. So you can go to dublindancefestival.ie, and it's in the Abbey and places like that as well. But you got into the board. Gosh, did you go on your own, by the way?
I went alone. Yeah, and I had a box to myself as well. Which was
did you get a box and everything? And you couldn't entice anybody. No plus one.
No, I couldn't. Everybody I knew was busy that night, you know. And it's funny, I've got tickets for Bruce Springsteen. You played Bruce earlier on. And I have tickets for Springsteen on Sunday. I have a queue of people queuing up for
now.
My Bruce Springsteen tickets this weekend.
Have you seen him a couple of times?
I have, yeah. I saw him at the RDS, and I've seen him a couple of times, and I've seen him at the old Point Depot as well, the Devils and Dust Tour, which was amazing. Oh, he's just incredible. Like, he's my favourite artist. So,
even, you know, for proper... Oh, he's your favourite artist. Like, is 3 hours a bit too much?
Ah, no, I'd go... Like, you know, I always leave going, I could have done with an hour more of that. He's absolutely extraordinary. Like, there's just never a dip in the energy. And
there's never a dip in the energy. But, in fact, the band all take breaks, don't they? But he stays on.
He stays on. And every time I see him, I remember buying a ticket from a tout... outside Crow's Pub in Ballsbridge years ago, 20 years ago, because I thought this could be my last chance to see Bruce Springsteen. I paid something outrageous for a ticket, thinking I may never see him again. And 20 years later, like here, or 22 years later, I think here we are, you know.
I think I went to see Ennio Morricone's last concert twice,
right?
If not three times.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I actually did miss the very last one that he did. He's dead now.
Yeah,
but
you saw him, like, that's
the
thing,
right? Oh, we
saw
him, that was the thing. Yeah, absolutely incredible. And, actually, he just took very few breaks, but he does take breaks. I always think at the very start, in the first half hour of Bruce Springsteen, there's some of the super fans are even kind of struggling to name the song.
Yeah.
Because he's such a huge bank of music.
And
he changes his
set list. Yeah, yeah. And I was a little bit disappointed with the last tour that he didn't play more songs from Letter to You. And I've seen the set list.
Yeah.
I'm going on Sunday, and I've seen the set list from previous concerts, Belfast in particular, and he played maybe two or three more songs.
Yeah, played Letter to You last night.
And like, there's a song called House of a Thousand Guitars, and the first time I heard it on that album, I thought, this is made for the big stadium treatment,
right.
And
I
couldn't believe he didn't play it, like, you know.
He's got so many hits. Do you have one that really moves you when it comes on?
Oh, Thunder Road. I mean, Road for me is, I think Thunder Road is probably, if I had one Desert Island disc, you know, they've been on Desert Island discs where you get to pick one, it's Thunder Road.
Is it?
Yeah.
Even the opening is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like a Tennessee Williams. It's like a Tennessee Williams play. It's like screen direction or stage directions. You know, the screen door slams, Mary's dress waves like a vision. She dances across the floor as the radio plays Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. I mean, it's just that's
magical.
Stage directions. It's amazing. It brings tears to my eyes.
And is there a crap one?
No, you know, there's a couple of them, like
What's your toilet song?
I don't have a toilet song, but there's a couple of them that actually sound a little bit, lyrically sound a little bit like David Brent's Free Love on the Free Love Freeway. But because it's David Brent, you laugh and it's naff. But when Bruce sings about, you know, a pretty girl sitting on the hood of a Dodge drinking warm beer in the soft summer rain, it's different.
It is different. Like
if David Brent sang that, I would laugh, but because Bruce sings, I love it.
You could kind of, you could spew out a bit of AI Bruce Springsteen, can't you? An old tramp on a 49er, whatever that is, by the railroad.
Yeah, on the edge of town.
On the edge of town, and the private equity fund comes in and pays you $500 million for your music. We won't mention that for the weekend, isn't it? Come here, what are you up to at the moment among all the things there?
Well, I just finished the latest Ross O'Carroll Kelly book, which is out at the end of August, and it's book 24 in the trilogy. So I have,
24 in the trilogy.
I plan to do three and I never stopped.
It's 24 novels, but you have some spin-off ones.
Yeah, I did. I did a book guides of and things. Interviews with the characters from the books, and then I did a Ross Guide to South Dublin, which was like a travel guide to South Dublin. And then I did a collection of the Irish Times columns as well.
So all told,
it's 27 in 24 years. So, yeah, it's a lot.
That is unbelievable.
I need to lie down after that. And we finished work on the next season of Bad Sisters as well. So I was a writer on that. So that wrapped, as they say, in TV land in January. So
I
think it's in the autumn.
You did another one of those because it seemed to be well wrapped up, didn't it, season one?
Yeah, it did. Well, it was based on the Flemish TV show, which was called Clan.
Yeah.
And so there was just one season of that. So with season one, I suppose we had a template. With this one, we had to dream it up again, you know, dream up something new. And it was so much fun to work on, you know, like it's an incredible cast and just such a great creative team around it.
It's great to have such a prestige TV series made in Dublin. That's
And you know what as well, I don't think Ireland has ever looked as well in any TV show or film ever, you know, just the use of drone footage to capture, you know, the Sally Gap and Sandy Cove and Hoth and Malahide. It just looks so spectacular. And the year it was filmed, I think it was a terrible summer from memory. I think they got the sort of five sunny days in
Ireland.
That's why
it looks so glassy and lovely.
But it has, I know all over the world, people now know about the 40-foot, like everybody, you know, lots of visitors know about
it. Really did
about
become
the
a character,
tower,
didn't it?
But the 40-foot became a character, and lots of people go there now because of Bad Sisters.
Did you ever solve the mystery of why they painted the thing green? Because it's white, isn't it? The changing thing, and they painted it green.
What did they paint green?
The paint at the 40-foot.
The 40-foot.
The changing lump of concrete, whatever that's called.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's green in the show.
I don't understand.
Because they famously painted it green, and then they painted it back to white again to leave it exactly as it was. And I was like, what's going on there?
Yeah, no idea.
Okay, sorry I asked that now. Actually, I was thinking of, because you have such great names in the Ross O'Carroll Kelly books, I think my favourites would be Nama Mia, Downturn Abbey, which is really good.
Yeah.
But although I should have got off at Sydney Parade, is that what I should have got off?
Yeah, should have got off at Sydney Parade.
I know that's not like a pun on anything, but
that was the one that got people kind of, you know, asking each other, what's that about? Like, that sort of created a conversation.
Yes.
Whereas the others are kind of puns that people sort of chuckle along with and say, oh, I get that. You know, there's always a cultural reference in there. But Should Have Got Off at Sydney Parade was, what is that about? And then this became this conversation about what does it mean? I don't know if I'm allowed to say it on your show. But it's a method of contraception.
Okay,
at Sydney Parade.
I've forgotten that one. Okay. Obviously, because it's so long ago. That's about 20 years, isn't it, that one?
It is. It's 20 years next year,
It feels like it's in every house in the country. That's where it kind of exploded. Was Camino Royale, was the one last year?
Camino Royale was last year's. Yeah, it's funny, every house in the country, whenever I go into somebody's house, I gravitate, I'm such an egomaniac, I gravitate to the bookshelves.
I
look sideways and go, don't see many of mine here.
I have some, if you haven't come up with the title yet, but have you got the title for this year as well?
I have, I can't tell you that.
Balls Bridgerton, it was my...
Oh yes, that's
not,
brilliant.
Not terrible. The Far Roish, I thought
the far right is very, very political.
Political one. Immigrastones crisis. You could see I was going down a particular road. Yeah. If anyone, feel free, 51551 to send in ideas that Paul will never use.
You never know.
Amazing interview with Paul. Oh, you never know. Love his speaking voice. Great guy. I would go anywhere with him, says Miriam in Dublin.
All right.
Hot and heavy.
Would you come to interpretive dance with me, Miriam?
Maybe, yeah, that would be the ultimate test, wouldn't it? Paul is merrily married at the moment. By the way, I saw in a documentary years ago that you keep bees.
Yes, I do, yeah.
In Boca.
Yeah, I don't have any at the moment. Oh. I lost them all about 3 years ago. And it is I mean, I will have more again. I've got empty hives, but it's one of the things about keeping bees. You don't get too upset when they swarm and you come and find an empty hive.
They swarm away.
They're so hard to keep alive. That's the problem, you know, with all of this sort of environmental obstacles that they face, you know. When you manage to keep one alive throughout the winter by feeding them sugary water, like I literally go to the hive and feed them a bowl of sugary water every day during the winter. And when you get them through the winter into April, May, and you see the hive thriving, it's such an amazing feeling of success.
I'd say, and they take off on their own then, do they, for the summer?
I mean, you can leave them alone. You can kind of go to the hive as often or as little as you want.
You just keep looking. What would you do?
I go there sometimes and just sort of take the roof off and take a frame out and just look for the queen, you know, if you can find the queen. But they're amazing things. They all have jobs. They live for about 90 days. A bee lives for about 90 days. And everything is for the common good. And they just work. Everybody has a job at any one time, and they all go through an apprenticeship which involves doing several jobs. So only the females. The males don't do any work. At the end of the summer, they're dumped out of the hive. That's their price for being lazy. They're dumped out. So the hive in winter is all female.
It's all girls.
But they do things like undertaking duties where four bees will carry a dead bee to the edge of the hive and drop it out.
You're not making this up.
No. They don't like decomposition in the hive. So everything dead in the hive has to be put outside.
Wow.
And they're dying all the time. Like there's just a constant cycle of bees hatching and dying, dropping it dead from exhaustion.
It's all going so well.
Yeah.
They sound in many ways like bad sisters, don't they? They're pallbearing sisters all in the hive together.
It very much is a sisterhood. Like a hive is a sisterhood. Yeah. And I just love them. Like I love it. It terrifies some people, that sort of insistent buzz.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it. I could sit there for hours just listening to them work.
I presume this is something you know already. David Beckham keeps bees as well. Do you know that?
No, I didn't.
Well, caught you out on. Well, it's a test, so you never know if it's true. Oh, by the way, we had Kelly Harrington in here the other day, and she was upset because she was telling us about herself and Mandy's dog, Macy, died in January. Yeah. You lost your dog as well. Iconic.
We lost Humphrey, yeah. But it's 4 weeks ago now.
That's the big droopy-eared basset.
Yeah, he was a basset hound. And he lived to a great age. He was 13 and a half, and bassets generally live to about 11. 10, 11 is a good life for a basset.
Right.
So we knew for the last 2 years we were in injury time, if you like, with him. But he was a gorgeous dog. He's the first dog I ever had. I never had a relationship with a dog before. And he trained me. I didn't train him. Like I just gave up trying to train him. Well, I took him to obedience classes once, and they just laughed at me. They just said, "You don't teach a basset obedience. Like bassets, is he house trained?" I said, "Yeah," and they said, "Well, you're already winning. Just write the rest off as personality."
Yeah.
And I did, and I just let him away with everything. But he was my constant companion. Like I took him to work every day. I get up at 5. He got up with me. We went to work. He was with me all day. We had a routine where, like, I'd be driving to work, and we'd stop at traffic lights, and he would sort of place himself half in the front. We had this box between the two front seats, and where you put your keys and your phone and everything, and he'd put his jaw on that, and I would chat to him, and then at traffic lights, I would sort of grab his paw, and we'd have a little chat, and then, you know, that was us. We had our routine. And as soon as we were done with the traffic lights, he would settle down and sleep in the back. And so he was with me all day. He would sleep under my desk while I worked at my feet. And 11 o'clock exactly, he would wake up and go to the front door to bark at the postman as he put the letters in.
Go away.
And then he'd wait for his lunch and then we'd have our walk. So all of the sort of biorhythms of my day are set to having Humphrey, and now he's gone. And that's the hard thing. Like, I do, honestly, Oliver, I keep looking behind me to see, expecting him to see him there, you know. And it's, yeah, it's a tough thing. You know, our place is so quiet now as well. And he has beds in every room. He's got beds.
Very sleepy dog.
He has a bed in every room we own. And
oh, no. You can't.
We can't move. We can't put the bed away. We don't know what to do. And his toys are still on the floor where he left them. And it's kind of like we've said goodbye, but, you know, in a way we haven't said goodbye. And it's a funny thing. Like I know how to deal with grief for a family member, but grief for an animal that you loved is a completely different thing. And I don't even know where to begin. You know, it's
it's sort of a, people will think I'm weird if I'm sad about the animal.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't talk about it all the time because, you know, and people do change the subject very quickly when you get tearful about your dog. Like, you know,
I can hear that it's a big part of your life.
Yeah, it was huge. You know, he was there for 13 and a half years. He was a huge part of our lives. And it's just a lot quieter around the place.
I mean, another dog is the solution in a way.
Yeah. Mary and I, we kind of feel that it would be unfair on the next dog because we had Humphrey on such a pedestal. Like, you know,
yeah,
it's like, you know, it's like, you know, no dog could compete, but maybe in 2 years' time, we might
again.
A totally
different breed, for instance.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I'm not sure. Bassets are so peculiar, you know. They're their own personality. Humphrey never did a single thing I told him. And I can put my hand on my heart and say in 13 and a half years, he didn't do a single thing I told him to do. If I told him, if he's about to get up on the couch, which he wasn't supposed to do, and I said, that's it, up you go, he would stop and go, I'm not getting up here just because you told me to. And he would wait 5 minutes until it looked like it was his idea to get up there. So that's what you're dealing with. And I'm not sure if I could handle a dog who did what I told it to do.
Yeah, it would be too much of a change. Listen, thanks so much for coming in and being our visiting critic, Paul Howard.
Pleasure.
We're looking forward to the book, whatever it's called, in August, you said.
August, the end of August, yeah.
And are you still doing readings and so on, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm doing the Dalkey Book Festival this year.
Oh, I love the name of this show. What's
I'm kind of a big deal around here.
Yeah, that's a good word. Like,
well,
I said, egomaniac.
So I thought, you know,
it's very suitable. So big deal, Paul Howard. Thanks so much for joining us. A little bit of caution just before our next item. We'll be discussing mental health matters and include suicide as well, so in case that affects you. But our chat here will be all about helping people because PJ Gallagher is with us. Welcome, PJ Gallagher.
Yeah, morning. Thanks for having me.
Comedian, presenter, now mental health warrior. You'd be normally presenting now, wouldn't you?
I would be at this time, yeah. I'd be just about finishing over and over now, yeah.
And thanks for making the special effort to be here because you're babysitting this morning, weren't you? Your two little...
Well, yeah. I don't think you're allowed to say baby. Babysitting one of your own kids. I've made that mistake a couple of times. God, it's like I'm fine. I'm at that stage where not being in work is so much harder than being in work, and it's never been that case before. Like, it's just such a busy house, but it's all right.
What age are the twins?
They're not even 9 months. They're 9 months next week, it's full on. I don't know what I was thinking. You know, I'm trying to talk about doing things that's good for your mental health, and I decided to have two babies when I'm nearly 50.
It's supposed to be the best thing that happens to a fella in their life, isn't it?
It is. It's a great thing. It is a great thing. But my God, it's hard. Like, it's so much moving. Like,
What are their names so we can properly judge you?
Oh, sorry. Milo is the boy and Stevie is the girl. Yeah, yeah.
So. Well, Milo is a good kind of old Dublin name in a way, isn't it?
I've heard that a few times. Yeah, yes.
Milo
a couple of people. Yeah, so there is a bit of an old Dublin thing to...
A golden age of acting or something in the...
A little bit, yeah, yeah. Milo O'Shea and sort of Stevie Nicks, I guess. That's what everyone says about the girl being called Stevie. But there you go, yeah. So,
have you put Bo's baby grows on them yet?
I have. It was one of the first things we did. I know that's a bit cringe, isn't it? But we did.
No.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
When it comes to Bo's people, we just have to accept that there's There's a madness, if I can say it.
There's a madness to it, yeah.
Bohemians.
The first day we took them out of the hospital, we took them up the Daly Mount Lane, so that'll show you.
Did you actually?
We did, yeah, because their mother runs the women's fan group, the Mononobos group, so like she's a lot more into it than I am even. So when they got out, the first day they were born, we watched Bows and Derry on the TV, on LOI TV, and then when they got out, it's like they got out of prison, we went straight up to Daly Mount Lane and said, is where it'll be. So
you have a bad there for
have
sure.
a bad
but yeah. That's how you met your Mrs. Mother of your children,
yeah, through the club, through Bohemians, yeah.
Which is, I forgot that we had to mention there was a mother to
there is a mother. This is driving her mad as well, because everywhere we go babies. Because people kind of know my face, it's everywhere and it's happening a lot. It's like, oh, well done PJ, fair play to you. And then they say to her, will you take a picture, and she's like, oh my god, I am going to kill everyone. Like this. Yeah.
Well, we're having a cheerful conversation so far, and it's good. And there is plenty of cheer in this documentary.
There is, actually. I think mostly it's a documentary that's kind of has a hopeful element to it, I think.
Very much so. Yeah. So how are you? And I really mean, how are you?
Yeah, thankfully, very, very good. It's so nice to be able to answer that question genuinely and be able to say really, really good. And while at the same time anticipating people seeing me talk about my very, very worst. You know,
yeah, because when you talk, we tell men to talk about their mental health, and if they're feeling low and whatever, you know, they're doing it with their family and friends. Maybe a trusted work colleague might know, but someone like you, you're in the public limelight. Do you worry about how people view you in that way? Or?
Well, I mean, that's kind of, I think it's just, maybe it's amplified, maybe it isn't. It's very hard to know. I'm not sure if it's much different for people who are suffering. You know, with mental health or mental illness and stuff. I just think for men in particular, I've never been a woman. So it's, you know, I can only speak from my own experience. And that's the thing. I'm not an expert or a professional, so I can only tell you my story.
Very good, yeah.
And I seem to have nothing very unique to other lads. You know, when I was in trouble, I just couldn't say it. I just couldn't come out and talk about it. And when I did come out and talk about it, I wanted everyone to just keep my secret. That was the big point. I'd rather die of shame than tell people I was sick. And that's the truth. Shame was my big fear.
Yeah.
Rather than like not being alive, I was more afraid of shame. And I think a lot of men, when they're in trouble, when they're sick, that's exactly what they feel. They'd just rather not be here than be embarrassed. And it's crazy. When I talk about it in those terms now, it blows my mind that was my logic. I really felt that if I told people I was sick, I was gonna. I genuinely believed it. I'd lose my job, I'd lose my partner, I'd lose my friends, I'd create a stigma about it. It felt like I was going to my own funeral. That's kind of how I felt. You know, when you go to a funeral, you don't know what to say, so you just say sorry or, you know, I hope you're okay, if there's anything I can do. It's tokenistic, and you do it because you just don't know what else to say. And that's kind of what I thought it was going to be like. I'd say to them, people go, oh, I don't know what to do, or if you ever need that, and if you do this, and they go into the mental health conversation tropes and nothing would change. That's what I felt.
Yeah.
And the mental health conversation that was going on at the time, I felt completely excluded from, because I wasn't suffering from a little bit of depression, or I wasn't suffering from anxiety, and going for a walk and eating a salad, that wasn't going to make a difference. I had to be hospitalised and be watched 24 hours a day for a considerable number of weeks, you know, and you feel excluded from people saying, talk to your friends or do something. And
that feels glib then, compared to the huge intervention.
I mean, I made the comparison to someone that you never tell someone you're struggling with your physical health. It doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, if you were in a big accident, you were hit by a bus and you were lying in the hospital and, you know, you don't say, I'm suffering with my physical health. If someone came in and says, oh, yeah, I know what you mean. I didn't go to the gym the last few weeks. It's not the same. Like there's a health maintenance thing that's really, really important. And then there's like seriously ill, chronic, badly need intensive care to some degree. And
that's the expression you use in the documentary, that you nearly died of shame.
I did nearly die of shame. That's the truth. Yeah. That's as sort of accurate as I can portray it.
How long were you in psychiatric care?
In 12 weeks, so 3 months really, yeah. I went in just before Christmas and got out and was back on air on the 1st of March.
Back on air?
Back on air on the 1st of March. Now, they did tell me not to do that. They did say, when you leave St. Pat's, hospital, don't go straight back into going on air.
Yeah, like, any job.
But I did, that was what I wanted to do. And honestly, I was feeling very, very good. Yeah. Very, very good at that point. And I've maintained that to this degree. So.
And how long ago was that?
When was it? It's nearly, is it 2.5 years now? So yeah, okay? Yeah. Because I hit it, even when I got
out.
Well
done, by the way. 2.5 years. That's amazing.
Yeah. And that's it. I'm flying, you know. And that's it. I even when I got out of St. Pat's, I still hit it. I still was involved in the lie. The cover-up was still important. Even though I felt completely good, great, getting on with my life, I was still afraid of the shame of people finding out.
Yeah.
You know, I still was going into work with Jim McCabe every day and saying, don't tell anyone, and thinking people didn't know. I disappeared off the face of the earth for 3 months and nobody said a word.
Yeah.
And then I just came back and people still didn't say a word.
Mm.
And neither did I. So I was complicit in the mental health cover-up.
Whereas if you had an injury, that was a physical injury, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. People would be doing your head in. You know, if you come in with a cast on, you'd be sick to your teeth.
They'd be going over to sign it.
What happened?
Wouldn't they?
What happened? Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Whereas with a mental illness, it's like, oh, there's no signing of the cast.
Don't know what to say. Like going to the funeral again. People just don't know what to say. And that's changed with me now. Now it's completely the other way. Now I hear everybody else's stories everywhere I go.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
And that's great. You know,
yeah.
People say, is that hard? No, it's not. It's great. I love it. I have no problem with that at all.
You've talked about the fact that you had good health insurance at the time, so you could get care.
Yeah. So I was very privileged. You know, essentially, I was privileged enough to have access to services that I think most people don't. And that probably saved my life because I left it so late to get help. And that's the thing. It's early intervention is everything. I was 6 months down the road being sick before I did anything about it. And I never had to get as bad as I let it get. And that will never happen again. I'll never be that sick again because I know not to let that happen. I know how to tackle it now. I have a toolbox I never had before. I know I have doctors to call, friends to call. I'm not ashamed of anything anymore. I know what to do. So the next time I get sick, and I will, it's recurrent depressive disorder, that's fine. I'll be in charge. It won't change my life.
Mm.
And that's really important.
The wounds have been healed in many ways, haven't they?
The wounds have been healed. And I know it's nothing to be afraid of now. Whereas, you know, it was such a thing to be afraid of before. So.
What do people say to you when they come up? Do they come up randomly, by the way?
Randomly all the time. Yeah, randomly all the time. Most of the time it's other lads saying, you know, fair play to you, or, you know, I've had my struggles myself. Sometimes someone will tell you their whole life story. That can be a bit much, but that's good too, that they feel they can, to be honest. Sometimes it's people coming up and saying they lost family members. Sometimes it's people saying, have you any advice for me? Which unfortunately I don't, because again, I'm not a professional, but, you know, I can tell my story and say, like, a lot of people say, there's someone in my family struggling, I don't know what to do. And if that's your case, you can get help as well. You know, you don't have to fight that battle on your own either, because it's really hard on the people around you too.
When you talk about things like grief, that there's a cause for the depression that might result from that. Did you look for reasons for yours? Because often there's no reason, is there?
That's it. And I think one of the best things I did was abandon caring why. You know, for me that was a huge thing. Is it hereditary? Is it experiential? Is it any of these things? I got to the stage, I just don't care.
Mm.
All that matters to me is staying well and feeling good and enjoying my life. I don't care how I got sick. It doesn't matter.
Is it a bit like, as well, how did the accident happen that injured me?
Yeah, it's
exactly. You don't dwell on that too often. You know?
Yeah, well, if you've a broken leg, you're telling the doctor about the registration of the bus that hit, it doesn't, it's not important. It's all of what's important is, you know, walking again.
Yeah. The message basically is to get men to open up, isn't it?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, not just men. When I was in the hospital, it was pretty much 50-50 men and women. It was, that from my experience. So basically anyone, but I do think it's harder for lads to sit down in a formal setting. It was like, it was really, really hard for me. For me going to a counsellor felt unusual, and me just getting involved in the mental health conversation of, are you all right? You know, how are you feeling? Talk to your friends. I found that very difficult. I did. What worked for me was friends coming over and saying, there's something wrong with you. And I'm going to help you. And whether you like it or not, I'll break into your house and help you if you don't want to tell me what you want me to do. You know, it was stuff that being quite forceful in my life.
Right.
My friends of mine being able to make jokes about it to my face made me feel lighter about it. So there's no right way or no wrong way to talk about it. And I think that's important as well. You have to be able to own your own story. You have to realise that you're not going to say the wrong thing There's nothing unique about it. Mm. You know, you can use your own words in any way you want to say these things, and it's fine. It's terrifying, but it is fine.
It's kind of embarrassing, awkward, all of those things.
All of those things.
There's an amazing moment in the documentary where you have a chat with the members of the motorbike club, and they're mostly men, aren't they, in the circle. And one of them starts talking in a way that perhaps others in the group didn't know.
Yeah, it was a very big moment for all of us in the club. We met to just see how open people would be to a mental health conversation.
Because these are people you know a long time.
The people I know a long time, but people that I meet up and we talk about, you know, bikes and scooters and, you know, Vespas and we...
Men talk. About everything but the pig.
Yeah, yeah, weather and matching football and giving out about music and, you know, and then we had this day and some of the conversations that came out on that night were kind of incredible. And Andy told his story, which I think it changed the course of the documentary, really.
Yeah, it did. We have a clip of it here. Andy's in the motorbike group.
Andy Keating, he's one of the main men there. And I don't think anyone knew his story to the
just
to the degree.
To give people a setting, it's the most manly setting you could imagine because, like, literally fellas in biker jackets.
In patches
surrounded by engines.
It's all in a patch.
Grizzled looking fella. This is Andy.
I have issues as well. I've been suffering for maybe 6 years now. And there's one or two people here which I have spoken to about it. It's not easy. Literally, after the last episode, I went to bed. I was in bed and I got out of bed and I come downstairs and then I tried to commit suicide. And then the next day I got onto the phone to pay the house because there isn't anybody else. Like, God, I can't afford to go into a doctor every week and say, okay, 80 quid and sit there and go, how are you, blah-de-blah. Blah. For me to come over here on a whatever, if it's on a Saturday morning or whatever it is, I walk in and it's, how's it going, Andy? How are you getting on? And then I go home, smile on my face.
Extraordinary.
It was an amazing moment, it was. And Andy kept talking about it then and still has to this day. And he's opened up and I know, like, Andy's had his battles, like, and because he did that, other people started talking. You'll see it on the night on the documentary as well. And it's an ongoing conversation now. All meeting on Saturday. They're all going to make a video. They're all, you know, it's just been brilliant, you know. And I think when you hear your own voice say these things, it's very encouraging because one thing I keep saying about depression and anxiety, both of them together, like, they are the most articulate liars ever that live in your head. Mm. And it's very hard not to believe that voice because that's the voice that practices itself and its routine in your brain over and over again to tell you how worthless you are, how pointless you are, how you can't do anything, how you'll never achieve anything. You can't argue back because you're not experienced with arguing back. You're experienced with hearing this voice. So sometimes just hearing yourself say it makes it more manageable. Sometimes
it's more powerful than the voice in your head.
Other people saying, I've been there, I've done that.
Yeah.
Don't believe that.
Becomes familiar.
Don't believe that. And if you're listening to this now and you have that voice, or if you think those things, you hear those, you feel those feelings, I'm telling you, it's a lie. It's an absolute lie. And you can make that stop. You can stop that cycle. You really can.
There is a way.
There is a way, yeah. And it's available, you know. It is there.
When speaking of mental health struggles, you went to your doctor in the documentary and there's a revelation for you here, wasn't there? There's a diagnosis.
Yeah, there is a revelation for me and I'm still not sure how I feel about it. I got diagnosed with ADHD, which is not a new thing. That's obviously been something I've had my entire life.
Yeah.
And I'm still kind of struggling with it because I still don't really know an awful lot about it.
I'll tell you what ADHD Ireland calls it. So it's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, neurodevelopment differences affecting 5% of the population roughly, leads to challenges in organisation, focus and self-regulation.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that's the kind of technical description.
Yeah, that's the technical description. I guess the reality, in reality, it sort of makes itself shown in different ways. I mean, it makes perfect sense. What the one good thing about it is, it's made sense of so much. I look back on my life now and I think, oh, I wasn't a completely dysfunctional weirdo that was just terrible at school. It was just the wrong environment for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can take pride in the fact that, well, I've made it work anyway because I've, without any guidance, I've found these workarounds that have worked for me and that continue to work for me and, you know, I pulled it off. And that's great. And now I can manage it going forward. And now I have options going forward. I don't know if I'm going to ever, I don't think I'll take medication for it or anything. I'm coping. I'm enjoying myself. I enjoy my life. If I get distracted, if I make mistakes, I'm all right with that.
You know yourself a bit better.
Else cares either.
Is that fair to say? You know yourself a little bit better.
I know myself a little bit better. That's for sure. Yeah.
Text here, PJ, you are amazing. There's great freedom the day we learn not to give a damn.
It's really, there's so much power in just not caring. There really is. That's all true.
And there's a lot of power in this documentary. PJ Gallagher, Changing My Mind. It's on next Monday.
It's on Monday night at 9:35 on RT1. Yeah.
Monday 20th of May, just after the news there. The Motorbike Club WhatsApp group.
The Pit Stop Crew. They'll be delighted. The Pit Stop Crew.
For the petrol heads, what did you actually arrive in here riding?
Oh, I'm on a Triumph Tiger today. The Pit Stop Crew are all Vestas.
That'll mean more than anything we've said to some people. listen, for people out there who do need help and are affected by anything, rt.ie/support has all the details there. If you don't have access to the internet, the Samaritans do great work as well, non-judgmental. They listen to you. 116123 is the number. 116123. They're actually marking, I think, 10, 15 years of that number as well. PJ Gallagher, thanks a million.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Continue to be well.
I will do. I promise you that.
So there you go. Kelly Harrington in tears over her pet. Paul Howard bereft over his pet. But PJ Gallagher to give us all hope rounding off the podcast. It is the end of the podcast as you know it. I'll be back on the radio next week. If you have interesting stories and things you think we should know, then pop an email anytime to us. oliver@rte.ie. That message system thing malarkey is open all of the time. So thanks a million. Cheers. August Slán. Podcast out.